I got this.
All right.
God, I hope.
Hey, this is Mr. Bowen. I am here to introduce a 100 of something side project where my son Andrew and I are going to watch all 100 of the AFI's top 100 films of all times. We're starting with Ben-Hur, the 1959 super colossal classic.
Yes. Ben-Hur was directed by William Wyler. It was produced by MGM, and as Will said, it was produced in 1959. It was starring Charlton Heston and about 6,000 extras. The original source material for it was called Ben-Hur, A Tale of Christ, which was published in 1880, and it was written by a guy named Lew Wallace, who was a Union general. Now, the really cool thing about this is that this is not even the first, like,
film version?
Yeah, film version. It first started out as a silent film in 1907, and then MGM bought the rights to it, and they made a silent film starring Raymond Navarro in 1925. Now, 31 years later, they decided that it would be a good idea to make it again, and I guess they were right. Since then, it became a direct-to-video film in 2003, Charlton Heston voiced Ben-Hur. 2010, it was adapted into a television show, and in 2009, it was adapted into a stage play, which apparently is pretty good.
Hmm.
Yeah,
that'd be interesting to see the chariot race in a stage play.
I would kind of like to see that. That'd be pretty awesome. I suspect it'd probably be a little bit lower budget.
Okay, so we're gonna kind of give a general review of the film, and we're going to discuss overall parts of things, how things have changed in cinema since 1959 when this film was made.
Mm-hmm.
We're also gonna do that with the rest of the other 99 films. So I'd like to kind of start out by mentioning that this film comes with an overture.
Yeah.
And an entr'acte. So it's kind of unusual, even for films of the time. It's such a long film. It's such an event. I mean, the thing clocks in at 3 hours and 22 minutes.
Good God.
And there's no credits at the end of the film to sit through, so it just sort of ends, the end's done, that's
Thank
it,
you. Good
we're,
night.
We're out. That leaves the music, the score of the film to be played in an introductory thing, kind of like a stage play, like when you go to see a big event, a Broadway musical or something that's playing in the auditorium when you first go in to see the film.
Yeah.
It sets up the story, which begins roughly around the advent of the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
It's a big event in the book. It's a big event in the movie, the first 10 minutes or so of the movie gives you a kind of an overview, a pastiche of the Romans saying, okay, everybody in Judea, you got to go to your hometowns and report for a census. So there's a number of vignettes that are showing that if you already understand the biblical underpinnings of the story, they don't ever actually have to tell you who any of these people are.
I have to admit, though, my favorite part of that particular set of scenes was the Roman centurion. He was taking everyone's name, and one of the guys that woke up said, name, Joseph, and, you know, other information. Who's that on the donkey? That's my wife, Mary. All right, you guys can go. So it was kind of like one of those, like, hey, there's a cameo.
If you didn't at this point know what was going on with that,
yeah,
then you catch on quickly. There's a star, there's a manger, there's a bright light, there's the three wise men. They show up, and then all of that ends, and we start the movie.
Yeah, that's
so
the other 15, 20
minutes now into the thing, after sitting through the overture, we are now finally actually going to get to the title card of the film.
Yep.
Which is juxtaposed over the creation of Adam, painting, the Michelangelo painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which I find extremely interesting because that doesn't actually have anything to do with the story that's being told. It's a beautiful painting, and one that I'll probably get to on the other part of our 100 of Something podcast at some point, or if the story of Michelangelo happens to be one of the top 100, we'll certainly discuss it then, because that's another Charlton Heston film. But I just found it strange that they did this biblical epic, and I understand the God and everything, but there's this sort of image that is said there, because this isn't a creation story. This isn't a beginning of the earth story. It's certainly biblical, but it's just, what does that have to do with the rest of the, I mean...
kind of my theory is that, like, I had this idea that when I saw that, I was just like, I think they were just trying to find something that was, you know, this is obviously a biblical story, this is obviously, and they wanted to convey that with the painting. So instead of, they probably would have been better off if they did something like, I don't know, Da Vinci's Last Supper.
That could have been a good one. Yeah, that could have been a good one.
I think it was kind of just like to immediately establish the association of, okay, this is a story that has God in it, that kind of thing.
That may be, but I think they also established that by putting the bright light over the manger and the star that runs across the sky, has a circle around it when the scene is over, and then blinks out of existence.
Yeah, that's like, we're done.
Let's turn off that light.
It burned out.
Oh, everybody. Everybody, we found the guy. We're good.
He's right here. Hey, guys.
That's super awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and then the three wise men show up. One is, oh, God, there's a really bad joke in there somewhere about...
let's pass over
anyway,
there.
Anyway.
So, the three wise men are first shown in profile, and they have varying stereotypical noses of Egyptians and far-off... Asian, that kind of, it's a really strange sort of like, wow, that's a portrait right there.
Yeah.
So here's what you get for backstory. The new Roman consul shows up to the Jerusalem garrison. He's going to take over. He's going to be the number one guy there reporting directly to the governor. And he's a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's all about, there's some uprising, there's some stuff going on. He's like, you know what? I'm going to make an example out of everybody.
Yep.
Find me the leaders. We'll cut, you know, we'll just chop them off at the top, and then the movement will die out.
The guy that he's replacing is
obviously a little bit more taken with the sort of, you know, like, you know, I've been living, he's gone a little bit native. He's like, I've been here for a while. Maybe you'll understand when I'm a little bit older.
Well, maybe these guys
and
have a little bit of a point.
They bring in, and this is, they talk for, you know, another 10 minutes or so. And finally, now, 25 minutes into the film almost, we finally get to meet Judah Ben-Hur, Charlton Heston, in the flesh.
Yes.
There he is in his robes. He walks in, and it turns out that he and the consul they grew up together.
Right.
They were buddies when they were kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
There's some really, really serious unrequited love subtext going on in this thing. I don't even know if it qualifies as subtext, obviously. It spoke volumes that the actor playing the Masala, the actor playing Masala is very much into the subtext of this scene as it's written. Charlton Heston is... not. I think he's definitely playing it. This is an old friend of mine. Here we are. We're going to throw some spears.
Yeah, that's
we're going to toss the first thing we do. We're 2 minutes into our meeting. There's a long hallway where they run and embrace. They're glad to see each other. It's been 15, 20 years since they've seen each other, something like that. And the first thing they do is they grab these long pointy objects and they toss them.
Yeah.
So there's that. Just let that sit on your ears for a little bit.
Oh, here's the best part, though, is that after they've gone into his office and they're, like, drinking wine and stuff, they first of all, they cross arms and drink, you know.
When they toast each other's life turning out the way they want to, the Roman has wanted to be back in Jerusalem all of his life. He requested the garrison.
Mm-hmm.
Judah Ben-Hur is a prince.
Yeah.
Of the area, and when they toast, after talking about toasting for almost 15 minutes, they finally do toast. They pour big goblets of wine, and then they link arms.
Wedding style,
and drink from the cups. Maybe it was a tradition of the time, maybe, I don't know.
Maybe.
But There have been many, many rumors over the course of years about when Gore Vidal rewrote that particular scene, mm-hmm. and he threw in some homoerotic subtext to it, some overt stuff. And there's this thing that Heston had always denied that it was there, and that they were just mm-hmm. trying to, you know, he kind of downplayed Gore Vidal's work on the film.
Yeah,
but it's pretty apparent.
Well, it couldn't also hurt that right after they'd linked arms and drank to each other's health, that they did a fade cut to the two spears,
sticking out of the wall.
Yeah, and then you know, moving on with the rest of the movie. That's it.
And then that's totally forgotten, because in the very next scene, Masala goes to Ben-Hur's house.
Yeah,
and they have an argument.
Yeah.
Ben-Hur,
fascinating culture until we destroyed it,
basically says that he is not going to rat out his the troublemaker guys, the ones that he's been talking to about peace and everything. They're cool,
yeah.
But Masala wants him to rat out the guys that are like, no, you know, screw the Romans. We don't want to live here anymore. He says, no, I'm not a rat. I'm not going to do that. And Masala gives him a strangely the message is, you're either with me or against me.
But,
so given the choice, he says, well, I guess I'm against you. So that's that.
Yeah.
Governor comes to town. Some tiles fall off of Ben-Hur's roof.
Yep.
Strike the governor. He's knocked out. Masala has him and his family arrested.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even get to the story starting.
But
well, maybe that is where the story starts.
I think that might be where the story starts. But before we
40
before
minutes
we get
into
there,
the movie.
Good God. but before we do that, there's this little thing that they bring up where Ben-Hur, who is the hero of the film and owns slaves, his slave accountant shows up with his daughter, and you know, he's talking about, oh, hey, you're making me rich, I'm making it rain! And anyway, but what happens is the accountant's daughter is getting married, so what Ben-Hur does is grants her freedom, and you know, it's all very nice and all that, and then later that night, they have a scene between Ben-Hur and, God, what was her name?
Esther.
Esther. God damn it, Esther. She talks about how, you know, she didn't really feel like a slave, and now she doesn't really feel all that free, and, you know, it's an arranged marriage, sort
mm-hmm.
of.
Mm-hmm. She's only seen the guy once.
Yeah, because
right.
he travels a lot.
So I think what we're getting at here is that they go up into this loft apartment area.
Yeah.
And Chuck puts the moves on her.
Mm-hmm.
They end up a scene in a very tight two shot with the light streaming down, and she's looking up at him, and she's got all moony eyed.
Yeah.
Kisses, and then the music comes up, and like, oh, I see. So he hasn't seen this girl for like 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and then we're supposed to believe that suddenly she gets reunited, she falls immediately in love with him,
yep.
he falls immediately in love with her, and they're now going to be some kind of star-crossed lovers thing. They meet.
You think.
I mean, he tells her, if you weren't going to be married, I should kiss you. And then she says, look, if I wasn't going to, you know, I should kiss you goodbye. And then she says, if she wasn't going to be married, then there would be no reason for goodbye. Like, they've been, it's like,
you've known each other for, like, 2 hours.
You knew each other in the past when she was a little kid, and now you've seen her again for, like, 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to put the moves on her.
Yeah.
I mean, good on you. I mean, well done. That's,
yeah.
That's moving some stuff. And that sets up some stuff for the for later on in the film,
mm-hmm.
because right after that, he's arrested. He gets sentenced to the galleys for attempting to kill the governor.
Yeah, for attempted murder.
And Masala knows that the governor was an accident. He knows that the whole thing is just a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
But he sentences him anyway because, you know what, he's a tough guy.
Yeah.
And he knows that if he sentences even his best friend, then nobody's going to screw around with him.
Which, as I recall, later on in the movie, that didn't really do shit. I mean, it didn't really matter, did it?
No.
Yeah.
What, the friend thing or
we never knew if that actually had an effect on the populace because everybody seemed pretty rebellious.
We know what happened because the stories that the other stories that are being told outside of this movie, all the biblical stuff, and you're supposed to already be versed in your biblical history. So.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot it was the 50s.
Right. So we're 40 minutes into the film, and just like we're now 15 minutes into this podcast, and nothing has happened.
Nothing.
Nothing. We have had all set up. Now, let's compare and contrast this to a movie today.
Uh-huh.
So today, first of all, in the first 15 minutes of a film being made today, even something as epic a scale, and I say epic in quotes with Ben-Hur,
yeah.
We would have already established in the first 15 minutes, one, that there would have been a scene added for the childhood of these boys together.
Yep.
There would have been a very clear indication,
that
whether it was with
other.
A color or a costume or something, that they knew each other and that the reuniting would happen. That would take, a minute.
Yeah.
We would have probably have dropped the entire scene of the birth of Christ.
Yep.
Because we would presuppose we don't have to show any of that because we can drop in a little thing, a tiny little thing.
Blessed
in
all the meek. What?
Let's not get into the comparisons with any of the other
sorry.
Films that we were comparing while we were watching this. yet we'll do that.
Oh.
So we would have a scene where they have met.
Mm-hmm.
We have a scene that establishes that they met before and they'll meet again. We have, and they would do something like they would link arms and they would say, and they'd be six and they'd be like, I'm going to be your friend forever.
I'm going to be your best friend even if we do.
Forever and ever, and I'll come back to this desert hellhole if it kills me.
You.
So there is that. Okay. So there also would have been some sort of introduction of Esther,
mm-hmm.
in some capacity, whether it was in that same scene, she would have been the little servant girl off to the side or whatever. There would have been a little thing so that we could, come back and say, oh, there's a character.
Mm-hmm.
There would have been horse riding.
Yes.
Charioteering of some sort.
You think so?
Probably some kind of thing.
Yeah, or they were just
that indicates that he's athletic, that he does some things because and I think today we would go a lot less of the movie. We wouldn't go 20 minutes into the movie, 25 minutes into the movie before introducing the main
character.
Yeah. Which is it worked,
yeah.
But there's so much talking and oddly, the pacing wasn't bad. It didn't drag.
It didn't feel like it was.
It was like, oh, here's Charlton Heston. Let's check the time. 25 minutes we've been watching this thing, and here's Charlton Heston for the first time. 40 minutes now, and 40 minutes in, and nothing has happened. There was the love theme when the big swelling violins.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's an accident. We are now at an inciting action. This is where we start the story.
Yeah.
We've introduced the characters. We've now established all these things with long scenes.
Yep.
We are starting the story.
Yeah.
My note, I'm writing from the back of a notebook forward, so my pages are backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Chuck gets arrested. He gets thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm.
His sister and his mother also get arrested. The servants are left in the house.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Spare the servants.
Which is, yeah.
What?
We'll release them. Okay. Well,
Yeah.
Except for the one old lady who runs up from behind and that Roman guard just grabs her by the arm and tosses her the other direction. Which is a nice... There's a bunch of little background-y stuff that in this film, which is interesting to watch. And we'll get to a couple of those things. So, he gets arrested. He escapes from prison. The most dramatic thing that has happened so far in the film, and there's, as you pointed out, Drew...
No music.
There's nothing. There's not a note. There's not a drum. There's not a da-da-da-da-dun.
No.
Da-da-da-da-dun. Nothing like that.
No music.
No music at all.
All you hear is...
You hear...
Of his sandals.
Scuffling of feet.
Yeah.
When he strangles a dude with a stick, and there's no noise.
Yeah.
There's nothing. And then bashes him against a wall, so there's like a clinking of rocks. But, and then he breaks into Masala's apartment.
With a spear.
And another
spear.
Threatens to kill him with a spear. But you know he's good with the spear because he threw it all the way down that hallway.
From 2 feet.
And hit the cross. But now he's got this thing. So Masala, of course, threatens him. He's, you kill me and I'll make sure. Somehow he's going to make sure that if Heston kills him in that scene, that he's going to make sure that Heston watches his mother and sister be crucified that day.
Yeah.
Which is a weird sort of, I guess he's jotting down a memo in the clay tablets that are
still
very troubling.
Hey guys, by the way, clink, 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 clink. Please remember to...
In the event of my death, I have ordered that these two people be executed immediately.
I think that what happened was that if we were to translate that scene into, stuff that the kids today can understand, it's basically a situation of, all right, you know what? This is what's going to happen. After we're done here, if you kill me, I'm going to haunt you. I swear to God, your ass is haunted.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're getting into the meat of the story now.
Yeah.
Now, because here's this action scene, he's punched out some jailers, he kicked a guy, he broke loose of his bonds, he strangled a dude to death, he goes, he threatens the thing, and then the next scene is him walking across a desert in a chain of people.
Yeah.
And
again.
And they're all very thirsty, and this is where, and this is the scene where Heston, where Ben-Hur meets Jesus.
Yep.
In his little town of Nazareth. So they stop outside Jesus' house. At the well,
yeah,
which is convenient,
yeah,
and like you would do anyway. That's fine. So they're stopping, and the Romans are being bullies, and they're saying no water for that guy over there, and they're specifically pointing out Ben-Hur. He gets no water.
No water.
And every time
that they try to bring him water, one of the legates comes up and just drinks from it.
Drinks from it, or kicks it out of the way, or something like that, until he's on the ground, and Jesus hands him a bowl, and he's like helping him out.
Actually, it's not really Jesus so much as a guy in a wig with a very long dress.
The back of Jesus' head, which was a stylistic choice for from the director. He definitely chose not to show Christ's face throughout the entire film,
which was
except for some very long shots where you couldn't make out anything anyway.
Even style, it was kind of awesome.
It was pretty cool. It was definitely an interesting choice, so that you're not going to get any comparisons to Max von Sydow or any of the other people that have, any of the other white folks that have played Christ over the years. So there's this, that happens, and the next thing we know, it's 3 years later, and Ben-Hur has been on a boat for 3 years rowing.
He's been rowing for 3 years. He grew a magnificent beard. He's cut. He's feeling good. He's tan.
Although I don't know that he's as cut as he would have been had he been actually rowing a Roman galley for 3 years.
Yeah, he'd probably be a little bit more on the bony side.
A little bit. But, okay, so they introduce the next mover in his story. So far we have had in this story his... his escape is the big action.
Yep. With no sound.
And then nothing.
Yep.
And now he's on a galley, and really nothing's happening other than people are leaning back and forth.
Yeah.
And, they show some boats from the outside. They introduce a character. He is another consul of Rome.
Yep.
His name is Arius. He's played by Jack Hawkins, who is one of my favorite... that's that one guy. He's in that other, he's in so many movies from the 60s, the big, he was in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yep.
He has this presence about him, and here he is as a consul, and the first thing that they do to show that he is a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's even tougher than the other guy.
Yeah.
But he points out different slaves, and he's like, okay, so when do these guys get changed out? And like, every 30 minutes we change a third of them, whatever. And there's regular intervals, and like, okay, well, I agree with that. And then he goes and he says, number 41, who is Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
He points at him, you've been staring at me with your eyes of hate and everything. Yeah. And then he lashes him, and he's like, oh, your hate will burn within you. It's like, oh, it's the emperor from Empire Strikes Back. It's gonna be a terrible thing. But to show that he is sadistic.
Oh yeah.
He then sits down next to the oarsman, the keeper, who's banging on his drum, and orders them to
battle speed.
And then attack speed, which I guess is different.
Yeah, that's different
than battle speed.
Battle speed is, you know, in position.
And then ramming speed.
And all the while he's sitting there looking like he is masturbating.
He's just, he's got that face on him. He's just, you know what, I know what I'm doing under my toga. Hey guys.
He's smiling.
You can't see my hands. So there we are. He's talking about, he's sitting there and he's watching his slaves and he gets this like glint in his eye like,
Wait, oh, it's Christmas time.
Oh, here we go. Yeah. And slaves start croaking. They start falling over and they beat on him.
And Ben-Hur is not giving up.
Ben-Hur is just, he's not going to give up.
Yeah.
But he's getting tired. He's tired. And finally, when Ben-Hur's about to give out, he says, okay.
Let them rest. And everybody
let them rest. And everybody's like, okay. Okay. So that scene lasted for almost 9 minutes.
Yeah.
There is a battle scene immediately following.
And by immediately following, we mean 20 minutes later.
And it wasn't 20. It was 10 or 12 minutes. But still, okay, so it's semantics. But still, the battle scene was 7.
Yeah.
So they sank an entire galley and several Macedonian ships. There's a sword fight of, you know, hundreds of extras with swords and shields, and they're throwing fireballs.
They clear the ship.
They're shooting catapults. They're shooting arrows. And that scene of epic battle of miniature proportions. And that was pretty cool because, you know, the special effects tank that they built for it had the ocean waves in it, but the boats were definitely
models.
20, you know, 15 feet long or 10 feet long rather than these giant triremes or whatever.
Yeah, they were really cool.
Very well detailed, and they're burning, they're on fire, but that entire battle scene lasted less time than the let's make them row and we're going to drop some of these guys.
I'm so cruel.
To establish how bad this is.
Yep.
And then the consul gets booted off the boat, and Heston saves him, and they move to the next step of the story. Now, this has been 3 years.
3 years.
So he got arrested, he escaped, he was captured again, he went into the galleys, cut 3 years later, he's in a scene about the rowing, and there's lots of rowing.
Oh my.
And then cut a year later, they're in Rome. He's won 5 chariot races.
Yep.
Ben-Hur now. He's won 5 chariot races, and he is the champion of Rome in the Colosseum, in the circus, the Circus Maximus.
And here's the other thing.
And now he's being adopted as the son
which is,
of Arius.
Yeah.
So he is now Arius the Younger.
Yep.
Also Judah Ben-Hur.
Judah Ben, yeah.
Who was a slave. So, okay, so happenstance aside, it's based on a novel that, you know, the guy had a point to make, and he was trying to make it and get this large circular life. He could show this life in Judea, life in Rome, back to Judea, tell a story from a Christian point of view, all this stuff.
He was very big about historical accuracy, apparently, and he wanted to convey that point as much as possible. But the thing about that movie that those particular set of scenes is right before it's a year later, he's won 5 races. He actually has a ceremony where he meets the emperor of Rome. Well, the consul does, right.
But that's the return from, from victorious battle. The battle wasn't lost.
Yeah.
Okay.
You get a part
so
of
I wanted
here.
To go back a little bit to the comparison now, make a comparison of the cruelty shown by Hawkins' character and the cruelty of a villain these days.
Oh,
so how do they show a bad guy is sadistic now?
They're generally
slit a throat.
They'll kill one of their own soldiers.
Kill one of their own soldiers
they'll
is a good one.
They're
like, oh, what a bad guy.
He's killing someone who's loyal to him.
And the rest of them are all like, he wasn't as loyal as me though. Yeah. So
rattle. They're shaking in their armor.
Exactly. But we've developed in the last, 50 years, a shorthand now for cruelty. So some of that existed. I mean, there was shorthand before then. You could show, you could literally have a face paint job in certain kinds of stage plays, and you knew, oh, that's the bad guy, because he has like a V on his head, and he had some sharp angular stuff features. So there's theatrical traditions to shorthand of the villain, and you know he whatever he does is going to be bad. This guy is a little bit layered, a little bit nuanced, because he turns out to be, you know, an all right guy.
Yeah, I actually kind of enjoyed his character, because he was just like, okay, he's kind of a bastard, but you know what?
He put them through the paces, he did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, honestly, I think it was just a situation of he was just doing his job. I mean, he wanted to see
what
they could do.
But, you know, just doing your job.
Well, I mean,
so it's a slice of life. You're supposed to be saying, oh, this is tough. It's tough to be a slave. There's cruel masters.
Yep.
And now he gets to see the other side of it where he gets to go to parties and he's the talk of Rome and et cetera. And they give him, and then he decides to go back to Judea. And we get finally to he's returned.
Still nothing.
His house is empty.
Yeah.
It's overgrown with plants.
Did we miss something?
Balthazar,
the introduction of Balthazar.
Oh, that's right. One of the wise men. He's going back to Judea. Yes.
Yes, he's taking a drink, you know, he takes a lot of drinks in this movie. He's sitting under a palm tree, he's having a nap, pouring some water over his head, and this old guy, who turns out to be Balthazar, one of the wise men, he walks up and says, "Excuse me, I'm looking for a man who's about your age who would have come from this general area." You don't say.
I believe
that when I find him, I will know. Then why did you talk to me?
Exactly. There is that. So there's some dramatic questions that could have been answered in a rewrite.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
So, but they got their Oasis scene in, and they introduce that now they have shown no charioteering.
None at all.
They have just mentioned, you know, almost 2.5 hours into the film that he's good at charioteering. He's won five races, which in a year, that's pretty good when you consider that these things don't happen every weekend.
It's not like a football game or whatever.
It's a big deal that he's five races in and he's won. So he gets back to his hometown, and he's back at his house. It's overgrown with vines. It's very dark.
Oh, it's very, very dark.
And there are leaves everywhere.
Yeah.
And who's there? Esther! Hey, Esther! All right.
Esther, why are you still here?
He's very in the foreground. Mm-hmm. He's in a shadow.
Yep.
In a boxed-in area, and she appears at the top of the stairs where she first appeared.
Yep.
And bathed in light.
Oh,
and there she
so
is.
Beautiful.
And it's a beautiful, and it's a very
carrying her laundry.
It's reminiscent of Baroque painting.
Yep.
It's got that sort of vastness to it. I mean, they're way across the screen from each other.
Oh,
this thing. She comes down the stairs. They're reunited.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, the music swells.
Yep.
Because we know that the last time they talked, he was all up in her business.
Oh, yeah.
And that was it.
That was it. Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm back from the dead.
And guess what? I'm still smoldering hot.
Hey.
And so are you. So, okay.
So I guess we're going to hook up, or what's the deal here?
And now I have to go see Masala.
Masala.
And then he walks off. Intermission.
Yep.
2 hours and 20 minutes into the film. Intermission. And we get 5 minutes of the entre-act music.
Yes.
To warn everyone to come back in from their refreshing popcorns and or sodas and et cetera to the main theater. And okay, so at the half, we have a hero who has been what has he been? I've lost my notes. Oh, there we go. Oh, no, I got to take it back a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't. That doesn't really matter.
Well, when he goes to see Marcellus Wallace, he sends him.
No.
Wait, this is important.
He goes to see Masala and says, "Hey, you know what? I'm in charge."
Yeah.
That's
right before the intermission.
Is it right before the intermission?
I think it's like the last scene. And what he does is that he sends him like this really awesome gift. It's like a knife or something like that. And
I did skip over something.
Yeah.
Didn't I? Yeah. I did.
Bro.
Oh, that's right. Because the intermission is... that's that backwards thing again.
Oh, God. So what happens is that he sends him a really nice gift. And he's like, oh, I can't wait to meet this guy. He's really good at racing and, you know, all this stuff. He's...
And Masala has taken up racing as well, which is mentioned at the Oasis when Ben-Hur meets the Arabian.
The Arabian merchant, played by a Welshman! Seriously? It's a British guy, it's a Welsh guy.
It's a Welsh guy in blackface.
Oh, God. And it's not very good blackface. It's not...
It's the rub off on the turban.
Yeah.
On the inside of the turban.
You watch it and you feel a little dirty.
Like, oh.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yay.
But it's okay because he was funny.
Was he? Because I think I would feel more racist if he was funny. But what happens is that they establish that because Ben-Hur is really good at racing, then therefore Marcellus Wallace must be as well. So
I'm a little uncomfortable that you. No, I'm not.
Oh, come on. No.
Marcellus Wallace is in a different film.
We know.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, we know.
Eventually, because it's in the top 100 as well.
Yes, it is.
Woohoo!
Yay! Anyway, so hopefully it's not as long as that one. What?
I think the next three films are actually shorter combined than Ben-Hur.
Oh, good God. Anyway, so they establish that he's really good at racing, and he's won 4 races, which... Okay. In the 4 years that he hasn't seen him, he's run 4 races instead of the 5 that he won in a year. So.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Yeah.
But he's out in the provinces, it's a little bit. It's a little backwards. Yeah.
But.
So they challenge each other, or they don't even really challenge each other to a race.
He says, "I'll see you
at
the races."
See, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much the.
But he demands. But Heston or Ben-Hur demands the release of his mother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, he can't find him.
Yeah.
And only Masala can do that for him.
Yeah, and this is actually a really fine example of just how poor the communication was back then, because Marcellus Wallace doesn't know what happened to him. He has no idea what happened to him. He's like, okay, well then we'll go
talk to... He specifically says that's not his job.
That's not my job.
It's not my job to pay attention to where the slaves go.
Exactly.
Where the prisoners are.
So they go to... Where do they go? They go to the warden, who has no idea, so they check their record books.
And they have an intake date.
They have an intake date.
So
they use
their cross-referencing system.
So where are they? East block.
They're
lower. And I think there's like supposed to be like some kind of dun-dun-dun there, but... There's
an implied dun-dun-dun, because if he's in the east block, that's bad.
But
if in their lower, in their lower dungeon.
Is this like Manhattan, Lower East Side?
I don't think it has any correlation. Probably doesn't even have a correlation to Eastern Block.
Anything.
Oh, they're communists.
Oh my.
No, I don't think that's... I don't think they were that overt. although there were quite a few strong references to the Romans and the... Nazis, and then
that was actually kind of interesting. Every time, I found it awesome that every time that we saw them go Ave, you know, raise their hand, we both went Hey Nazis.
That's true, and it was the salute, which has become, of course, has been more related to Nazis than it was to Romans, which is where they got it from. Anyway, so there's so. They go into the dungeons.
Yep.
And they a long scene of how far down deep in the dungeons these two women have been.
Deep.
It's way down. I mean, they're going down M.C. Escher stairs to get to the place where they are.
They
and then they bend. And they have to bend over and crawl and like creep down.
Which is actually the best example I've seen of what a
dungeon would look like in that area. Then they finally open the door.
Oh, right. But right before, they're like, have you seen them?
And not for 3 years. We haven't seen them for like 3 years because, whatever.
No, I have never seen them because I've only been working here for 3 years.
How do you know they're still alive?
Food's gone.
The food disappears. We put the food down and it disappears. So, okay. So they've done all this setup to get to where they go. They open the door and you see them coming through the door from the hallway. And you're in the cell now with... Yeah. the two ladies. And the torch comes in, and the guy's face lights up, and he gets the
and then
he gets
there's
the
music.
Shock
and
look,
then
and
music.
Then there's music, but we don't see the the ladies, and he backs out of the cell. Like,
nope,
we have to go. They're lepers. Music sting.
Yes, lepers finally.
So then a Roman goes in to look at them.
Oh, I
and
don't
we
believe
see the
you.
Same
oh, are
thing
you kidding me?
From our point of view, as people in the cell, his face lights up. Music sting. Face, big eyes, big saucer eyes. He backs out of there. They have to be taken out of the thing and thrown from the city.
Yeah.
Close the door. Door's closed.
Yep.
Then they're going to burn the cell out, whatever.
Yeah,
okay.
Burn the cell out, all that good stuff.
So the leprous mother and sister...
Yeah.
Go back home.
Yeah.
Somehow they got back into the city.
Because they got thrown out of the city.
They got thrown out of the city. Somehow they managed to get back into the city, which is weird later because people are like, lepers, and running away from them.
Yeah, you can see them from a distance, apparently. Like, holy shit.
So there's that. And they go back. They meet Esther.
Yeah.
Who tries to get them to stay. They won't, though. They won't. And they make her promise to tell Ben-Hur that they're dead. So.
Yep.
They do that. She does that. He gets mad. And then he walks across the courtyard. And then it's the intermission.
Dun, dun,
so
dun.
Now it's, you know, big musical swell.
Yep. And I believe
Two hours and 20 minutes into the film.
I believe I made a prediction at some point. Right. Yes. At the intermission, I made a prediction that I knew that the next part of the film, which is on another disc, you know, the Lord of the Rings style
the
extended
DVD
box
comes
edition.
In two.
Please insert it. Please insert the second disc for your continued viewing pleasure. but I made a prediction, because it's an hour and a half, that I looked at it and I said, okay, here's my prediction. Because they've established that, you know, all this chariot racing and all that good stuff, 20 minutes of setup and an hour-long chariot race.
And I wrote that down. I wrote that. 20 minutes of setup and 1 hour chariot race. Now, at this point, at the half...
Yep.
Ben-Hur has been a prince, an oarsman, a charioteer, although we haven't seen him do that yet,
not yet,
and an heir to a Roman consul, taking him as his son. 4 years has passed, and almost nothing has actually happened. It's almost like a Greek tragedy. All the action so far, except for the boat battle,
which was 7 minutes.
Okay. Seven minutes out of 120, 142 minutes at this point. has been action-y. Oh, and there was the 4 minute or so fight.
Hell yeah.
Running musicless battle.
Dun, dun, dun,
so
dun, dun, dun.
We've had a boat fight.
Yep.
And then the sadistic rowing test.
Yes.
Okay. So that's where we are at the half. The entr'acte comes, 5 minutes of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice. It's, you know, a recap of the stuff. You hear the love theme.
Uh-huh.
So we know that's already happened.
Yeah.
It's coming back.
Oh, yeah, by the way. Yeah.
And we have a wagering scene when we come back.
In a bathhouse.
In a bathhouse. So a bunch of guys standing around in white towels, getting oiled up.
Yep, because it was the 50s, because they couldn't have an actual Roman
bathhouse. And the dude, and the guy from the Oasis, the Arab...
Welshman in blackface.
The Welshman in blackface comes back and makes a bet with the consul, Masala, that he's going to win this race, that his man is going to win this race. They ask him who it is. It's Ben-Hur, music sting.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 dun. Okay, so, hey.
Hey.
All right, so there we go.
So give me some odds.
So now the stereotypically crafty foreign guy in blackface is now going to get over on the man by betting him 4-1 and 1,000 talents is what he's going to be.
Yeah, how much is that?
I don't keep up on the Roman exchange rates for dead currencies.
Yeah, they were betting 1,000 talents, but everybody else before that were talking about denarii. So it's like, we don't know how much a denarii is worth. We don't know how much a talent is worth. So...
Right.
What? Again,
It's worth more than that. So 1,000 of them. And so he's going to have to pay 4 grand if he loses.
Yeah.
So, okay. So there you go. All right. Hey, and that's how That's how betting works, apparently.
Apparently.
So, the chariot race comes up now after this scene.
Yep.
And at what timestamp does the chariot race start?
21 minutes, 59 seconds. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, now, the chariot race has been talked about a lot, and it has been featured on, you know, greatest stunts and whatever, and there's a lot of things that happen in it. And I got to say that I think the thing that is impressive to me the most is that most of it wasn't done with rear projection or green screen or, you know, blue screen or whatever.
Yeah.
It was done whether the actors themselves were being doubled by stuntmen in the longer shots. There are scenes where Charlton Heston and the rest of the actors in the scene, the other recognizable actors, are being pulled by horses on chariots at speed, and they're actually driving these things, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
The longer shots where some of the stunts happen, you know, of course, that's you would expect that the stuntmen are going to be doing that kind of stuff. But when they're being pulled, even when it's obvious that the chariot that they're on is being dragged by a truck, and they're whipping nothing, and they've got the reins, there's still a whole batch of chariot guys behind them with horses. That there's no way. If those guys slipped, fell off the truck, whatever, I don't know if they were roped in or what. They might have been braced in some way. But, you know, they fall off.
They're dead.
There's a horse thing coming for, you know, there's a whole team of horses.
Yeah.
So it's impressive. There are some really brutal crashes in this. And it's not the sort of sanitized CGI stuff that we have now where, you know, you see bodies flying and you go, wow, oh, that's a dead guy. And he's not really, you know, he's like, oh, there's no weight to that body because he's obviously computer generated. And these guys fall off of their chariots and plop down on the ground. And they cut. It's brilliantly edited.
Yeah.
There's some very well-edited stuff where the cutaway and the cutback is so quick that you almost miss that they've cut away at all, and then the dude gets trampled by a whole team of horses
and a dummy.
And it's obviously a dummy when you see the arms flopping around or whatever, but still, there's some pretty good stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's brutal.
The crash, there's a famous now stunt where Ben-Hur's chariot crashes through another chariot bounces up into the air. Ben-Hur flies up over onto the horses. Now, the stuntman in reality actually fell off of the chariot. They thought he was dead for a little while, but he wasn't. and then they use that scene, cut it so that you know, Ben-Hur climbed back into the chariot and continued the race.
Yep.
Which is cool, but it you can see some real dangerous kind of stunts. So I recommend that you can see the chariot race without the context of the rest of the film, because the only thing that you have at this point that shows that he has any business at all behind the reins of a chariot is that there's a scene immediately preceding where he's driving a chariot
around. Yeah.
And it's a long shot, and it's a circus-sized
track,
but it's a long shot and it's not him, and then he drives the chariot up and parks it in front of the camera, and that's, you know, that's impressive. I don't know that I could drive a team of four horses, and you know, he probably trained for quite some time to be able to do that for the close-ups and you know, definitely so. But movie wise there's no introduction of this at all. It's just this thing that he does. And hey, by the way, he won five races.
Yep.
And now he's going to do this here, and here we are.
I have to honestly say, my personal favorite part of those of that scene was the people that had to run out and pull everything off the track.
That's right.
you knew in their minds they were just going, hey, there are some horses, and we have to go get that stuff.
Get the chariot out of the way. Get the other stuff. Get this rolled off.
Get the horses off
and
the scene.
And it's edited well enough that, you know, it worked. And it still works. Andrew here jumped off of his seat the first time a chariot tipped over.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, look at that. So for that to happen, where you know that it's 1959, you know that it's not real, you know that it's a movie, and you have that reaction. That means it still works. So so skip the first disc entirely.
Because you don't really need any context.
Because there's no context. You obviously don't need any context. Mm. The second disc of this film is as long as our next film.
Honestly, I think it's two movies.
It's a number.
You could have the
that
first
argument
movie,
is
first
made
movie
in so many different ways here.
Yeah,
but you could just to review this film, just to go and look at some of the things. You could watch that. You could watch that chariot race, and not cut the the last. Just make it a movie about a chariot race that happens, and you still have. There's a lot of stuff that happens after the chariot race, which is a kind of a big culminating moment, and it ties up the story and it ends some things, which is cool. So at this point, he wins the chariot race, and he thinks that his mother and sister are dead.
Yep.
He hears that they're lepers from the dying Masala.
Yep.
Who did better in the film, this film version? He died. In the book, he lives as a amputee.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he gets his just desserts for being a cruel Roman bastard. So there's that. So then the rest of the story is Ben-Hur trying to deal with trying to get his mother and sister out of the Valley of the Lepers.
Yep.
They're taking them to actually see Jesus.
Yeah.
Who at this point is being crucified.
Yeah, he was on trial when they got there.
When they got back to Jerusalem,
throw rocks.
And that actually led to another nice little moment in the movie.
Yeah.
There's a blind guy who gives them the information about what's happening. They have to get some exposition. So they walk up to this blind guy and say, "What's going on? Where is everybody?" He says, "Oh, they're at the trial." They say, "Which trial?" And he says, "The trial of the carpenter from Nazareth." And they're like, "Okay." So he plunks a coin into the Ben-Hur plunks a coin into the blind man's bowl, and as they're walking away, some people in the background shout, "Ah, lepers!" And they start throwing stones.
Yeah.
And while the stones are being thrown in this panoramic view, the leper or the blind guy off to the side of the screen just tinks his bowl. He bounces the coin, and then he turns the bowl over, and the coin drops out onto the dirt. Which is there you go. Yep. Not even the blind are going to deal with the lepers.
Yep.
Which is fine. So there's the magic moment where Ben-Hur is able to give water to Christ, thus completing the circle, completing his journey as a, I was a slave being beaten, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. You helped me. Now I'm helping you.
Yep.
And for that, he's given his spoiler alert, his mother and sister are cured of their leprosy as Christ is dying.
Post-crucifixion.
And
crucifixion.
Yeah. The doddle.
Yeah. Post-defense.
So the religious overtones of the film aside, you know going into it that, it says right on the title card, Ben-Hur, A Story of the Christ.
Yep.
Because it's not actually about Christ. But
I
thought that the religious aspects of the film, some of them were overt.
Yep.
You had Esther telling Ben-Hur, you should go hear this guy talk. He's pretty cool. I like his message. There's a Roman consul at the beginning of the film who he's misguided, but I don't think he's wrong.
Yep.
Weird.
That reminds me, there was a scene in Nazareth where Joseph is working.
Oh, that's right. Right at the beginning of the film, that Joseph is working in his workshop, and his friend, his old friend comes, and
he says,
"Where's this? Why is it my table is not finished? Why is your son not working?" "Oh, he's out wandering in the hills,
Well, why? Why is that?" He said, "Well,
he should be here working for his father." "Oh, he is."
Which means Joseph bought the story. What?
Okay, so
anyway.
So there's all these little things, you know, like, ah, that's silly, we don't want to have the Romans have many gods, and they have the one god,
yep.
and et cetera, and there's this message in this guy,
the
rabble.
Why would you
really
want a wife? I have many wives. That's just sharing.
That's just generous.
That's just generous, right.
So, finally, we have the crucifixion. There's blood being spilled onto the ground.
No sound. He's not screaming. That's the other thing, which I...
That's standard movie depictions of crucifixion.
Gotcha.
For Christ especially. Everybody's happy. There's a choir.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's reunited at the end. There's a hallelujah choir.
There's rain. Lots of rain.
Lots of rain. And then the end of the film is the Mount of Skulls, the Golgotha,
yep.
with the three crosses
yep.
empty, and some sheep herders, which mirrors the beginning of the film.
Yep.
So it all gets tied up in a nice little package,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. Overall, I would say the movie is definitely dated.
Oh, yes.
Is going to happen, you know, if you're watching a movie 50 years later, it's going to be dated, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
If you have, you know, the messages in it are pretty overt. You have a lot of, there's Christ, so you got to follow him.
Yeah.
They left out the conversion.
Yeah, he did.
They did
convert in the book.
In the book. He has the conversion moment that was not in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently that was controversial at the time a little bit.
Really?
Because
I'm pretty sure this whole movie would not fly in a modern cinema. In a modern movie industry?
You couldn't take that script and pacing and make that movie now.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You certainly couldn't reproduce the crowd scenes. There were some huge crowds.
Yeah.
Some reports say up to 7,000 people were extras
wow.
in that film, which, you know,
impressive.
Every single one of them had to have a costume
mm-hmm.
at some point.
That's
pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It was made in Italy for $13 million.
In 50s money, though, so...
Right,
yeah,
so we're still talking 20, 25
yeah.
or so million. But that's super cheap for a movie of that scale.
Yeah.
And it... There are pieces of it that kind of work.
Yeah.
Still. The chariot race especially still has, you know... Let me put it to you this way. When Lucas mm-hmm. compared his speeder race, the pod race or whatever,
yeah.
in the Phantom Menace to the Ben-Hur chariot race...
Wait, he did that?
I believe he was off his nut.
George Lucas has been off his nut for a while.
But that
was
an extra, like an extra little tipping off to the edge.
Yeah.
That because his was completely manufactured out of whole cloth.
It was all
nothing
CGI.
In it was real.
Well, then also, if you remember that scene, I mean, it was basically, hey, here is this giant at the starting position. There's this giant, like all these people are watching. And then it's empty for the rest of the track. That's the other thing.
All right, well,
yeah.
We're not going to get sidetracked onto that because
we could go
days. And hey, that movie's not on our list.
Yay! Woo-hoo. I'm so happy.
So there we are. Ben-Hur, we've talked about it. We've gone through it. Maybe a little bit more detail than we had anticipated. Maybe a little bit less than you wanted. We'll have to see.
Yep.
And we are right at an hour.
Wow.
So, everybody remember, when you're cured of leprosy, the first thing you need to do is touch everyone's face.
Yes. Look at all this leprosy I totally don't have.
Touch my face. I really don't have it. No, seriously.
Touch my face.
Touch my face. That's what we're doing. So, I think we've done quite well.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see if we can do this again next week.
I'm excited. Next week is...
Next week is Toy Story.
Yes.
Number 99 on AFI's Top 100 list.
Favorite movie of all time. Let's do it.
Ooh. Special treat.
Oh, yeah.
Bye.